The peace that I have in those relationships that I value more than anything else is when a friendship gets to a place where we can just sit and be mm-hmm. in the same place and not feel like we have to fill a space with something. We might talk about things. We might be doing the same thing, but there's no internal pressure. You can just be reading a book, or you can just be chilling and not talking at all. That sense of being with, because a lot of times when I would try and like listen to God, I'd be like, I'm listening. What are you trying to tell me? It's just letting myself be more aware of and being more appreciative of the fact that no matter what I'm doing, God is there with me.
Alrighty, well, we're back again with yet another edition of That Jesus Podcast. I'm your host, Titus Kipfer, also known as Francis James, and I'm joined by the Reverend Drew Latin, coming at us live from the snowy mountains of Wisconsin.
Yeah, well, we're not going to be live because we're recording this, and it's not snowing. But I do appreciate you going through the introductions, because it's been so long since we've actually been together doing this that I think it's valuable just to remind people who we are.
It really was valuable. I feel like I did a pretty good job there and just set us off on a really good foot here. So,
yeah.
Well, last week we released an episode in which I debated Matt Adams on pacifism. Did you get a chance to listen to all of that yet?
I did not listen to every last minute, but I think I got the best parts.
What were your takeaways? How much of it did you hear? You were live in the live meeting, weren't you?
Yeah, and I have to say, I kind of enjoyed the the live audio gathering. I mean, I don't know if we really need yet another platform, but I thought it was kind of cool.
It's a cool one. I really like the format of, is it Clubhouse? I believe it is.
Yeah, yep.
I just signed up for it. I think it's really cool. But yeah, what were your takeaways? Did I get thrashed, or did I defend Christian orthodoxy well?
I guess I would say Christian orthodoxy, anyhow. I guess I would say I wish it had been a more structured, formal debate where you had like you did with Doug Wilson once upon a time. You know, you had your piece, he had his piece, you went back and forth, you had concluding statements. Although I think you were more structured in that debate too than Mr. Wilson. But yeah, I felt like you really brought out one of the things I appreciated about it, and I appreciate it frankly about most debates on this topic. It's not at all hard for the nonviolent, non-resistant pacifist side to actually find that they have like the upper ground. Like the other side has to disprove. They have to be the ones, yes, but throughout the debate. And I think you did a good job showing that. I felt kind of frustrated about the whole pacifism term, because we're not pacifists. We don't believe you sit back and do nothing. In fact,
it's not what pacifist means. It's not the etymology of the word.
Yeah.
That's a very common misconception. I'm shocked that you do not know that, being an English teacher.
Titus is
the etymology of the word has to do with peace.
Yeah.
Okay. Not passive. It's not passive.
But like, it sounds like it.
It does sound like it, but that's purely coincidental.
Mm-hmm. Or at least some sort of cognate connection that no longer really exists. That makes me really curious about is passive and peace, are they cognates of each other or not? Anyhow, what I don't like about pacifism is it sets it up as if it's some sort of political position you're taking. And some
it
people
is.
Would say, yeah, exactly. And for me, it's a little more, it starts before you even get to the politics, it starts with this assumption that Jesus meant what he said when he said to love your enemies and all that. So, yeah, I like the debate. I felt like there were a couple of good questions that were raised, and I don't really feel like your interlocutor, although he was a nice guy, and he had some interesting points, I don't feel like anything he really said especially stuck.
Yeah, he was actually pretty effective in the debate in that because it was an informal debate, he was able to keep me on the defensive for the most part. Like what he would do when I would try to make a positive point is he would sort of ignore it and make 5 points of his own. So that's actually a very effective strategy if you're trying to make your opponent look like he was defeated, because the audience will forget the point your opponent made and they'll just hear five of your own points. So I don't think he was trying to do that, but it was a little frustrating for me. And so if I would do it with like him again, I would certainly want it to be more structured so that doesn't happen.
Yeah, one of the points that he made that you didn't really respond to, which surprised me, and I felt like with the structure, it sounded like he got, you know, it was 1 point to his favor. And I was like, eh, the whole thing about Paul making use of his citizenship.
Yeah. And I had never thought of that before. I don't think it's a very crushing blow against nonviolence. I mean, I would, if I was going through a very dangerous area, I would also make use of police protection. But what we don't see Paul doing is bearing the sword himself. But it was true. Like he kind of stuck to that script the whole time, and the script was making my position look inconsistent by the fact that I would, for example, call the police, mm-hmm. but I would not be a police. That is an inconsistent position on one level. And I did want to ask you about this because there's the conservative Anabaptist position, which is sort of that we cannot be in the government or the police, but we sure like the government and the police and the military. We're thrilled that they exist. We thank military personnel for their service and like we cheer them on, but yeah, we couldn't be part of it. And that's an inconsistent position because if it's a good thing, if the military and the police and all that is a good thing, then why should Christians not be involved in it? So I've rejected that position and I've adopted a Christian anarchist position that says it is not a good thing. The police and the military are not good. However, God does occasionally use them sovereignly, and that's what Romans 13 means. My position, however, is unpalatable, not just because of the name, but also because, and this actually happened in the debate where he walked me through a hypothetical situation of, you know, the druggie coming into the house, which always comes up. And at the end of it, like the druggie's coming at me with a knife and a police comes in and shoots the druggie. And he was like, was that police committing a sin against God? And I said, yes, I think he was acting in disobedience. And it was so frustrating to him that he was like, all right, I'm done. Like we're at a total impasse. And I understand his frustration. Like to say that policeman was sinning is completely unpalatable to virtually everyone. So whether or not it's true, it's we're not going to convince people from that approach.
Yeah, and well,
I'm wondering if there's middle ground somewhere between the conservative Mennonite position and hardcore Christian anarchism.
Well, and I probably find myself in some aspects not even really feeling like that's where the poles of the spectrum lie. Because I feel like in some ways I'm probably less conservative and other ways more conservative on the traditional contemporary Mennonite perspective on the issue. But I was just going to say his point there, and I remember him kind of like being very frustrated and exasperated when you said that he's in sin. I probably wouldn't have used quite the same language you did, but I understood you kind of had to because he did back you into a corner, which was good. I mean, good for him. I think what that highlighted was that we, even as Anabaptists have consistently rejected violence, we have also glorified it as a honorable thing. Maybe not a good thing, but something honorable. There's something honorable about soldiers going to war to defend their homeland. There's something honorable, you know, about, you know, Andy Griffith on the street corner making sure, you know, the drunks don't assault old ladies. And I guess my thoughts, that's the heart of the problem. We have to see the sword as fundamentally contrary to God's ultimate order of kingdoms. And ultimately, the powers that be are going to be torn down. And there are practical things we can do. I want to jump right away to the practical thing, because there's a sense in which I don't care too much about the hypotheticals, and I don't care too much about the theoretical, theological positions, because it gets to the reality. Can I love a person and kill him at the same time? What does it mean for Jesus' kingdom to come into this world and for me to be part of that, even though I have all these arches, these kingdoms, these powers around me? So I really liked what Jeremy Duncan said in one of our episodes this summer, where he talked about, why is your first instinct to call the police? Because you value safety. What's the actual loving thing to do? Is he actually a threat? Do we actually assume a druggie coming in, breaking into your house, that he's actually going to hurt you? And that's why I think we need to have this shift in our mindset to rejecting violence as a solution in every case. So I felt like he did challenge that approach. And yeah, I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, the another point that I was really challenged on was someone from the audience challenged me on one of my primary arguments where I was really trying to back Matt into a corner with. And that was to say, yeah, it's impossible to love someone and kill them simultaneously. Like, how is it a loving action towards someone to kill them? And should we not act lovingly to people in every situation? And the audience member challenged me and said, well, do you think you're more loving than God? Because clearly in Scripture and at the final judgment, God will be killing people. So that seems to undermine my position that you cannot love someone and kill them simultaneously. Like, is so I did respond in the debate. People who've listened to it will hear my kind of response thinking out loud. Yeah. But what are your thoughts there?
I think that was one of the best points that was made for the other side, and the most challenging. Really, it gets back to what we see wrestling with the sovereignty of God, what we see in the Old Covenant and his apparent command for people to commit genocide, and how that shifted in the New Covenant. There's a lot that could be said about that, but I still kind of shrug my shoulders at a certain level. I'm not saying this is satisfactory, but as I wrestle with that tension, I acknowledge its attention, but I also say, you know what? I can't actually answer for everything God does in a certain sense. But I know that the God revealed in Scripture is a good God, and he's been good to me, and Jesus is calling me to nonviolence. So even though there's a tension there, there's not actually a contradiction. And yeah. And I don't think just because there are questions I can't answer about what God does means that I'm off the hook for following what he's called me to do.
So how's life?
Oh, life has been kind of miserable the last couple of weeks. We got another virus or flu or whatever, but it's been good. Doing some web design and studying for my grad program, and finished splitting firewood for the summer, I think. So,
do your children wash their hands? Do they not wash their hands? Because Dr. Finney Curavilla was at our church on Sunday, and we're talking about how we so often miss church because people are sick, and mm-hmm. he recommended hand washing. So that's what it, you know, that's what it takes to come up with that insight, is PhD and starting in college. Wash your hands. So if your kids are sick, it's probably because you haven't taught them to wash their hands.
But I'm actually the one who was sick first. So,
you know, do you wash your hands?
I wash my hands. I wash my hands.
Do you touch your face?
The stroke's beard. I probably touch my face too much.
I wonder if we're not even supposed to stroke our beards. Should we pivot over to our guest?
Yeah, we should. I am excited to be here with, I hope a friend, David Carlson. You may know and love him from Twitter. And I don't really know you much beyond Twitter, David. So welcome. We'll talk about kind of why I asked you to come on and stuff. But can you tell me just a little bit about who you are and what you do and some of your background?
Yeah, so I have been I've been on Twitter now for I think just over a year. When I initially kind of started, I was just using it as a platform to kind of get some of my creativity stuff out there. I have one other Twitter account that's for something else that I made 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I just started listening and reading and just kind of engaging on Twitter and over time giving my input way less and just reading other people's input and within the circle of...
Isn't that what we call using Twitter wrong, though?
Yes. Trying not to assert myself as much as I can. And really just it's a lot of, over the last maybe 3 years, some hot button issues obviously have come up in our country with COVID, with race reconciliation, mm-hmm. With abortion, things like that. Like I've really most of, I feel like my job is to just read and understand that even if I don't agree with somebody's conclusion on something, at least understand why they're coming from that position, mm-hmm. and how they got there. Because, you know, 9 times out of 10, we're really just all trying to do the right thing. And even if our perception of what that right thing is skewed from my perspective, it's really important, I think, that we just kind of regard each other as human beings trying to do their best. And so that's kind of been my thing on Twitter, is just engaging and listening and every once in a while dropping some poetry.
Yeah, and this is what stood out to me, and a lot of our listeners probably already saw some of your viral work that went viral last week, which we'll touch on in just a minute. But you write poetry and you put it out on Twitter, write poetry from the text of the Bible, kind of placing it, reading through it as like it makes me feel like I'm seeing it there, which I guess is a cliche. But as far as poetry and on Twitter, it was just really fascinating, and I was impressed with how your writing kind of took me out of whatever I was doing in the moment and imagine like Genesis 1, 2, and 3 and the creation there. So we're going to talk about that. This podcast, That Jesus Podcast, we do a lot of discussion, or try to, about devotions, about how we follow Jesus in our daily lives and what it looks like to be his disciple. And so to actually have somebody that's worshiping Jesus on Twitter and engaging in poetry and Bible, I'm like, well, this is pretty different, and let's talk about it. But before we do that, let's talk about the thing that everybody knows and either loves or hates you for, your very model of a patriarchal theobro.
Yeah. So that happened. And it's ironic because you talk about, you know, you're talking about this grand poetry that I'm writing based on so far the creation, like showing the grandeur of creation and the agony of the fall and what comes after. And I've spent, I think, maybe 2 years now just writing through that slowly. And then this one little ditty that I put together in an hour of inspiration, that's what people latch onto. I guess that's how art works sometimes. That's how Twitter works, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was very clever. You talk about the patriarchal theobro. Can you tell me what a patriarchal theobro is?
Yeah, so a theobro, essentially, a theobro is to theology what a gym bro is to working out. There is nothing wrong with theology. I love it. There is nothing wrong with being really passionate about particular subjects in it, like being like having that as your specialty. That's awesome. I very much enjoy discussions like that. But a theobro is someone who's just obnoxious about it. Someone who has to be right. Someone who has their opinion, and if you disagree with it, you're probably regarded as a heretic, and you basically don't accept anything other than your interpretation as the facts. Mm-hmm. That's a theobro. So I want to make that clear. Like, this is not a dig at people who enjoy theology any more than saying gym bro is a dig at people who enjoy working out. It's the kind of person who really just has to be the one to show how superior they are. That's a theobro. And a patriarchal one is usually they go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. Someone who basically talks down to women. And even in some of the verses of that ditty specifically, I've observed like stalking behavior and, you know, just insulting and people refusing to, you know, they will respond to a post that a woman theologian makes. Argue.
Wait. Woman theologian?
Right, exactly. No, but they'll argue with the post and they'll bring up some quibble, and then the woman will say something back, and then the theo bro will say, well, I'm not going to talk to you. I'll talk to your husband, or I'll talk to your pastor, or your brother, or your father, or literally anybody but you. That's the kind of patriarchal mindset that I'm talking about.
Yeah, and maybe most publicly embodied in John MacArthur telling Beth Moore to go home.
Yes.
So your takedown here is modeled after the famous "I am the very model of a modern major general." And I don't know, guys, if you don't know Gilbert and Sullivan, then you really won't appreciate the genius of our friend David here. Are you going to sing it for us, David?
I am not.
Oh man.
And I let me check here real quick. Does my audio sound okay? Because it looks like I'm hitting red a lot here.
You sound good.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You can just edit that part out if you want to or not. I don't know. yeah. So I worked hard at the rhythm, and honestly, at a different day, this might have taken me 6 hours to do. I don't know. It's just this one, the line, "I am the very model of a patriarchal theobro," came up, and it came from a frustration, like a really deep frustration, and a third party one. Quite frankly, I've never been the target of any of these guys. I'm young, I'm white, I'm a male. Even if my opinions are terrible, I'm probably not going to be the same kind of target from one of these guys. Because as from someone from that persuasion, they tend to regard other men as much more on a peer level than they tend to regard women just by default.
Yeah. So they have a seat at the table.
Exactly. And for me, it's just a third party frustration, but a very real one that I was like, honestly, this is making me really upset. So I just started writing it, and I expected a few people to enjoy it. And quite a few people did, it turns out. I mean, it went about as viral as is possible, considering the very niche, you know, interest, where it's like Gilbert and Sullivan, and also theology, and also someone who would get what a theobro kind of was and had dealt with that. So, you know, that was kind of fun to see.
Yeah, and I didn't feel like you were saying, there's a, and help me out here if I'm wrong, but there's an error on the other side where somebody who's like hardcore complementarian or even identifies as patriarchal. Like I know a leading former Southern Baptist leader who would publicly identify as being patriarchal. And I don't want to vilify them either. A lot of the proof is in the pudding. But there comes a place where you just kind of have to sort of make fun of it. I absolutely lose my freaking mind if any woman talks. I hound their social media like jackals in the bushes stalk. I phone their pastors and decry the attitude of women folk. By this, I show my well-adjusted sense of what is right or woke, something like that.
Yeah, and that is specifically, honestly, the behavior. And I had a couple people ask, not directly on Twitter, but like, and I like theology. Does that make me a theobro? No, that does not. The person that I am lampooning here is the person who is doing this kind of behavior. So if you're not doing that, you are not the target of this. And I get it. You know, Twitter lends itself to overgeneralizations, and generalizations are kind of assumed often when you start talking about things like this. But no, it's a very specific kind of behavior and a very specific kind of person that this is about.
Yeah, and just one more question about that. Because it's fun to dunk on people we disagree with, like, let's be honest. But what about that mindset, like the John MacArthur, James White type mindset gets your goat? Like, why is this something that you're frustrated with? I don't know if you go to a complementarian church, an egalitarian church, or maybe you don't go to church, but like, why is this such a frustrating thing for you?
How long do you have?
We've got all the time in the world. We'll just put it on Patreon if it gets too long.
Or like a little bonus episode. So Being totally honest with you, probably the biggest source of frustration from this is I used to be that kind of guy. Now I can say I have never stalked anybody. I have never done anything as ridiculous as like calling someone's pastor and saying, "Hey, do you know that your woman folk are out here saying things about Jesus?" Like, I've never done that. But the more general sense of like, "Hey, my opinion on this is obviously the correct one." You know, there's a little joke. There's a thousand variations of it, but it's like, it's this, you know, this massive branching sort of family tree of denominations. And then it's this one person pointing at like the furthest along that tree and going, and this is where after 2000 years, we came along and finally got everything right. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to get into that mindset when you kind of grow up without a clear sense of biblical history. And of church history, because you just, I mean, I guess this is true of any discipline. Like there's this Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Where you learn a little bit about something and you feel like, oh man, I know all about this subject.
Yeah.
And you forget that you are just getting the tail end of centuries of wrestling with language and wrestling with culture and all these things. And so I think part of it is a frustration with my old self, you know, looking back 10, maybe 12 years, knowing that I used to be, to an extent, this way, having this arrogant mindset where, you know, my perception of, well, for example, the complementarian egalitarian debate. Over the last few years, I'm still moderately complementarian, but I have, but at this point for me, it's a secondary, if not tertiary issue. I think it's officially an egalitarian church. We have a woman who is amazing, and she's our associate pastor. And I have no problem going to this church, because for me, well, like you said earlier, in a lot of cases, the proof is in the pudding. Mm-hmm. And the simple fact of the matter is that even if maybe from my perspective, the structure of a particular household or of a particular church may not be technically ideal.
Yep.
Nothing is ever perfectly ideal. Like every one of us has something that we're probably wrong about. And for me, it's just what as I've read and gone from this attitude of like, well, anybody who is, you know, anybody who's egalitarian is clearly just doesn't care about what the Bible says. And to be fair, there are people like that will say, well, you know, Paul was just wrong. Exactly. Well, I don't accept that. However, I have it largely, frankly, through Twitter and actually reading and, you know, being humble and things like that. I've come to understand that there are so many people who have these arguments which are based on, okay, the Bible is correct. Our interpretation is potentially faulty, and using what else is in the Bible as a way to kind of correct our thinking on certain things. Mm-hmm. So even though I have not, frankly, come to the point where I'm like, oh, yep, absolutely complementarian, at least in church structure, is wrong, I have absolutely come to the point where I accept that there are a lot of people who are coming at it from different angles, and very sincerely so.
And also that there, even if you don't feel like it's wrong to be complementarian, there are a lot of people who do complementarian wrong.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing, speaking of proof in the pudding, where that's been a frustration. And maybe part of that is also kind of where the frustration, where I'm 32. When I was 19, when I was 20, I had this young guy mindset, like, I know all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I read the Bible and I interpret it correctly, because of course I have the default and objective viewpoint, but everyone else is influenced by culture. I would like to say I kind of grew out of that. Had that beaten out of me by the Holy Spirit. And so when I look around and I see much, much, much older men, largely, who have that same mindset, that is frustrating to me. And again, like, I have no problem with strongly holding to particular theological viewpoints. It's more, how do you regard people who disagree with you? Are they the enemy? Yeah. In the way that you treat them, or are they another person who's just trying to do the right thing? And I see a lot of that vitriol. I see a lot of that disrespect. I see a lot of that dismissing of people who are really just trying. And that I think is really what bothers me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. And I think it comes down to, for me, and this is one of the reasons Twitter is a disaster in some cases. Social media is a disaster in some cases. But I do appreciate at least an opportunity to be exposed to different voices. That in my, you know, I'm the pastor of a little church of about 30 people. And the group that I tend to most associate with, the Mennonites, we're a pretty isolated niche group ourselves. And to actually be able to hear outside of that silo is potentially useful. And it's amazing, as useful as it is, you laid out in your parody, it can be so toxic as well. But the question I ask, and I feel like you laid it out here, I'm going to quote one more line, and I won't make people listen to me sing it, is what are we centering ourselves, or are we centering other people and listening to them? And I think if we're centering other people in our Twitter feed or in our churches, in our dialogues with people, that's, we won't go wrong there. Now there are wrong voices you can listen to, but I think you're much more likely to go astray if you're listening to the sort of voices that inflame you and make you want to stand up for yourself and fight, rather than the voices that make you step back and reflect and consider. So you wrote, go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's one of my favorite Bible adjacent movies is Ben-Hur.
Okay.
Pretty old movie.
Which
not
version?
The new one.
Okay.
The new one.
I haven't watched
terrible.
The new one. Okay.
I've never watched like the original silent version, which is very, very old, but the one with, Charlton Heston in it.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite Jesus movies of all time because it doesn't actually show Jesus. You won't actually only ever see the back of his head, and that I think like three times. What you do, however, is you see his influence on the people around him. And there's this moment right near the end where where the main character, Judah Ben-Hur, has just been hating, and with very good reason. Like his family was brutalized. He was betrayed by the Roman Empire. He describes himself as standing in front of Jesus at the cross, and he said, as I looked at him, he says, I could feel the sword being taken out of my hand. Mm. And I think more than anything, that's what it comes down to. It's like the moment when Peter says to Jesus, hey, or well, when he stands up, I guess, and just puts action into it, and he just starts swinging the sword, and Jesus says, dude, that is not what I'm here for.
Yeah, well said. I'll post a link to your tweet thread here. People should check it out. Still waiting for somebody to do a video version of it, but you write, I boldly show my manhood in this all-important culture war. I make it known how strong, how long, how tough I am, and furthermore, opining on the loss of white and masculine hegemony, I simply can't accept that kingdom doesn't focus all on me. And that really lays out, I mean, you could apply this, frankly, you could apply this to people who are super duper hyper woke and constantly trying to virtue signal over each other. Usually it's the white majority that are trying to virtue signal how woke they are. But you're still talking and you're still making the focus of kingdom about yourself. So I really appreciated your work and I really enjoyed it. And I hope our listeners will check it out. But let's talk about your quote unquote real poetry now.
Sure.
So all I was kind of disappointed because your Twitter account is the Bible in verse, at the Bible in verse. And I'm like, oh wow, look at this. And I'm like, oh wait, he only has like three chapters from Genesis. Come on, dude, there's a lot more to do. But I like the first three chapters.
Yeah, that represents something like 1,500 lines of poetry, all with a very, very intentional, very specific rhyme and meter scheme. Someone asked me a little while ago, I think it was one of those random Twitter questions, like, what is one inconsequential thing that you are a total snob about? And for me, it's rhyme and rhythm, rhyme and meter in poetry. Okay. I have read some fantastic poetry, and I'm throwing that out there because I actually follow poets on Twitter, and like I have read some fantastic poetry, absolutely, that doesn't have any particular structure. And it's the way that it evokes imagery, like that is absolutely 100% poetry.
Okay, thank you, because I didn't want to have to kick you off and cancel you here for
100%.
Saying you hate T.S. Eliot.
100%. For me,
yeah.
What I like writing by and large, is I generally refer to it as epic verse, where what I exactly. what I'm doing is I am taking this fundamental account, this narrative, this story, this account, and rendering it into, you know, rhythm, into rhyme. And in a sense, that kind of makes it maybe more memorable. Mm-hmm. It also kind of makes it almost more emotional, because you're, even if you haven't, even if you've only read it once or twice, your brain picks up on it easier. And so it flows. And I think that the structure of that is helpful. There's a way that poetry like that can kind of get into your head and into your heart in ways that prose sometimes doesn't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, last year I read The Lost World of Genesis 1 by John Walton, and I'm coming from a young earth creation, you know, six days of creation background here. And so in the past, when I would come to Genesis 1, 2, and 3, I'm looking at it to tell me about the origins of the earth, and to tell me about it in a Western scientific way, you know. You know, 24 hours, 24, one day means one day, 24 hours, on and on. And to read John Walton, whether you agree with him or not, he asked the reader to step back and actually think about it in the way the original readers would see it. And so I don't read Hebrew. I don't understand the cosmology of, you know, the ancients, but I did feel like reading those first three chapters, and I didn't read every line yet, but I, you know, read a bunch and skimmed it and read a bunch. It gave me a sense of, wait, this is telling me a story with meaning, with symbolism, with motif, and it's drawing me in to feel something. And that's what I appreciated about it. For me, it actually made it less, maybe not less memorable, but it made it a little unfamiliar to me, even as it brought me closer to the picture and the story behind there. So I did really appreciate that.
Well, that's good, because, you know, maybe jumping into why I started doing this.
Yeah.
I grew up with this. I mean, I grew up with it, and I was born into a Christian home. My dad was a pastor for many, many years. Mm-hmm. Also coming from the perspective of, you know, the assumed, you know, 6 day and so on creation, I have, and, you know, maybe 25 times throughout my life been like, I'm going to read through the whole Bible. And so I start in Genesis and then, you know, I peter out sometime around Genesis 15.
Leviticus, man.
I have actually gotten through the Bible a couple of times, okay. And through large portions of it at once, which I think really helps kind of help with the overview.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
But in any case, being so familiar with particularly the account in Genesis, and with the way that a lot of English translations, and I don't know how to read any of the others, just it can feel really, because it's so familiar. Because it's so predictable. I've read this a billion times. I've heard this a billion times. I started writing because I was basically like, there's so much power being exhibited here. And it ultimately, it doesn't matter whether this happens over the course of a very long time or a very short time. What matters is the power of God that is at display here, the glory that is being shown here, and so much of it before anyone was even there to see it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, other than God, of course. And so as I kind of started writing this out, it was a way to really force me to see it. And like you said, to look at it with unfamiliar eyes, to really think about it and go, okay, yes, God created light. What would that potentially be like? What would it be like for light to exist as a thing before anything else did? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as much as possible, leaning into the imagery and leaning into the, the poetry of it, really, just like the iridescent waves that flew as breathed him from life himself, it flared, resplendent colors kindled through with beauty fierce and uncompared. Like, really just trying to get at that emotion. And from there, what would it have been like to watch entire continents lift out of the oceans? What would it have been like for the first sunrise, the first sunset? That's what I'm trying to get at. And then once you get a little bit further on, once you get to humans experiencing things, I shift from the grandeur of creation a little bit to what does it actually mean, at least poetically, what does it mean for God to create a being like himself? Like, what would it have been like for Eve to wake up and the first thing that she sees is the face of the one who made her? Like, and then jumping forward, mirroring that bit right at the very end when they're leaving the garden, what it would have been like for Eve to look back and see the face of her creator for the last time. Yeah. That's kind of the thing that I want to do with this, is for people to read it. And whether they're like me, they're so familiar with it, they just haven't thought about the emotion of it in a long time.
Exactly.
Or they're so new to it and the English translation feels kind of bland because they're not familiar with it. They're able to maybe read this poetry and go, huh, this is emotional and this is powerful, because God is a creative being. He is an emotional being. He is a powerful being. I mean, he is, in a sense, he is emotion and power itself. And we reflect that. So I don't know. That's kind of what and why I'm doing this. And like everything following from that with Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, just the loss that they must have felt. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. Yeah. And bring us back to the, and again, not to get too much into theory about Bible translation, but there's this sense of, do you translate it literally word for word, which nobody does, but, or on the other end, you have the concept of translating it in such a way that the person reading the translation is experiencing a similar thing to what the original recipients felt and heard and understood. And again, I actually teach middle school English, so this is kind of right in my wheelhouse. And not everybody will enjoy 1,500 lines of, you know, carefully framed, metered, rhyming poetry. But for those of you that might be into that, it really does. You did well. What does your writing process look like? How long did this take you?
So one sec, let me turn on my fan here. So I started writing, and I think while I was supposed to be working technically, like two and a half years ago, I think, I just kind of started writing out. I think I wrote like the first day of creation in a couple of hours. And, at the time, it was only like maybe 8 or 9 stanzas. I think it might be 12-ish now. And a lot of times inspiration will just hit. And I go through these feverish creative periods where for a month straight I will just be on, that's all I want to do. If I'm working, I have to really focus on working because all I want to do is make something. If I, you know, I have video games, which I enjoy. I have less time because now I have a kid in the house, but like, I enjoy that. I don't want to touch it. Literally all I want to do is just be making this thing, whatever that is. And I've made different things over the course of my life, but you know, this is the current project. And then I tend to just stop somewhere and then, well, stop for like a really long time. So I wrote a few days. I got up to the right at the point, I think, where I was trying to convey how God was saying, basically, let us make man in our image. And the way I was trying to convey that, I couldn't figure it out at first, and then I stopped. And I think for 8 or 9 months, I just, I didn't do anything with it. And then I was at a meeting for a group of youth leaders that I volunteer with, and one of them who was not an English major, but I think did some English minors, she started really tearing at John Milton's Paradise Lost. Mm. And I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but she was basically like, you know, this, that, and the other thing about it. And I'm not going to name her because I don't want a whole bunch of angry people looking for her. Be like, how dare you, you know, talk about John Milton's Paradise Lost like that. But that just really, I mean, all that did was bring back in my mind, oh yeah, I was writing something, which again, I am not going to invite hordes of angry people saying like, oh, my work compares to John Milton's Paradise Lost. Uh-huh. No, it doesn't. It's very, very different. And that's fine. Like, I'm not trying to set myself up for that. But it just reminded me, oh yeah, I was working on that thing. And then that it struck, I hopped back on, and a month later I finished both the creation and the fall narrative. Mm-hmm. And that it was at that point I started kind of pairing them with some free photography from Unsplash, I think, and mm-hmm. putting them on Instagram and sharing them to Twitter. And over time, just kind of going back and editing and retooling it. And then finally, in its more recent form, I very similar process for chapter 3, where I wrote a whole bunch and then kind of stalled out for a month and a half and then came back and finished it and then edited it. This time, actually, I got it out to a couple of people that I had met on Twitter, people who are way more biblically educated than me.
Sure.
who I was able to ask about a couple of sticking points, because as much as like I am trying to get at the poetry of this and really just kind of feel for the emotion, I'm not setting myself as like, oh, this is some kind of translation. It's not. Yeah. I would almost kind of look at it as more of a maybe like a poetic devotional,
yeah,
where it's something to help you maybe engage with the text. But that said, rendering it into poetry, I didn't want to do anything particularly egregious to, you know, what maybe some of the
authorial intent, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I actually enlisted a couple of people, one of them specifically to look at the bit when like Adam and Eve receive their, I guess, the consequence of their actions. Mm-hmm. That's a very fraught passage that a lot of people use in their culture wars. And so I had a scholar come in and look at that and be like, okay, this is not one where I want to put my particular spin on it. I want to, if the text is ambiguous, I want the poetry to be ambiguous. And so they helped me out with that. And then a couple of other people helped me look at chapter 3 and gave some really good feedback. So that's basically what my process looks like.
Well, so I have two more questions. The first question, I used to consider myself to be a creative person and, you know, I used to do music and play instruments, used to write poetry. Now I only write poetry when I'm like in a really unhealthy mental space and depressed. But what for those of us that are just distracted by family, by social media, by media, whether it's video or you talked about playing games, by just the busyness of life, do you have any thoughts on how to carve out space and become re-inspired to create? People can go to your website and see you've done like audio drama about sci-fi. You've done, you know, some really diverse bunch of stuff. And I sat here and looked like, wow, this dude, David, is really creative. How do you, and I know you said like, it just kind of left you and then it came back. Do you have any insight for how we can rekindle inspiration for creative work?
Man, that's a really interesting question, and it kind of ties into my relationship with God. So I'll try to answer in brief, but probably honestly most of my life I've been a very like emotionally even keel kind of person. Not very high highs, not very low lows, just kind of, you know, down the center. I'm just pretty low key. And as a possible side of effect of that, whenever people would talk about really like sensing God's presence, like having that, not just the knowledge of, but the relationship with God, I would, over the last couple of years especially, I've gotten really frustrated with that, because that's not something that I've personally experienced.
That mystical sense of God with me, right?
Exactly. Right now. And it's like, I look at it and it's not just as simple as, oh, it's just head knowledge and it's not heart knowledge. Like I know to the core of my being that this is real, that God is real, and that, mm-hmm. you know, everything in that. And I am just, I am loved by God. Like, I know that more than just head knowledge.
Mm-hmm. But can I interrupt you and say, I feel like sometimes, as being also a quote unquote intellectual, and sometimes have that, well, my co-host Titus tends to be much more mystical and I tend to be more intellectual, although he's also very intellectual. But that whole dichotomy between head and heart is something of a construct in itself.
Yes.
So
and I think that's, yeah. So, I mean, I for a long time, I kind of felt like, well, maybe that's just kind of the way I am. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, God creates us with different personalities and that those form over time. And there is something to that. I think God does and will approach us as, you know, without contradicting scripture, of course, like mm-hmm. he will approach us as we need. Absolutely. But for the last couple of years, just becoming more and more frustrated with that and being like, I think I should be at least occasionally feeling this. And yeah. It would be a lot of times the thing is, especially with having our child who joined our family last year, from state foster care, like being like having the wisdom and the patience and the strength to deal with situations and just knowing even in the moment God is with me and or he's giving me this patience, he's giving me this peace, he's giving me this wisdom and seeing that. So I know the Spirit's with me. But when I'm actually like reading the Bible or when I'm actually praying, I would just not get it. Mm-hmm. And I had a conversation with my pastor. Finally, I actually, you know, talked to an older and wiser person. Because, I mean, a lot of times people say, oh, just read your Bible more. And, oh, just pray more. Or even like, hey, praying isn't just talking, it's listening. And I tried that, like actively listening, giving space, you know, for silence and all that kind of stuff. But I talked to my pastor and he asked me this question, which over the last 3 months now has changed so much. He was like, David, for you, what is it about your relationships that you value most that you would miss the most if they were not there?
No, say that again.
So he asked me, what is it about your relationships with people that you would miss the most if they weren't there?
Gotcha.
And the most obvious example being with my wife, but I have other friends and I thought about it. It's the peace that I have in those relationships that I value more than anything else is when a friendship gets to a place where we can just sit and be mm-hmm. in the same place and not feel like we have to fill the space with something. We might talk about things. We might be doing the same thing, but there's no internal pressure. Mm-hmm. You can just be reading a book or you can just be chilling and not talking at all. That sense of being with is what I value most. And I'm an introvert. So there's something to that, of course. So I've been thinking about that. And what I ended up doing over the past couple months was really start putting the time, not even like, oh, you know, carving out solitude, although sometimes that happens. Because a lot of times when I would try and like listen to God, I'd be like, I'm listening. What are you trying to tell me? It's just letting myself be more aware of and being more appreciative of the fact that no matter what I'm doing, God is there with me. And so sometimes that's doing the dishes. Sometimes that's going for a walk. Sometimes it is just sitting quietly and being in solitude. It can also just be me reading a book.
Yeah.
And this is where we're tying it all back together, it very much breaks through when I'm making something. So to answer the question, like, well, you know, how can you carve out time? I say all that because it's not just, I'm not, you know, I don't want to give like the, you know, just make it happen, yada, yada. Yeah. It's consider for yourself what in your relationships do you appreciate most? And how can that maybe apply to your relationship with God? Because if he is creativity itself, he made us to be creative beings, and I think that he delights when we make things, whatever that is, mm-hmm. That will kind of feed into that. And even if for a while you don't have the inspiration, just reading a book or being with, doing dishes, things like that, and just being aware of and letting God be there with you, even if you don't feel like he has to be saying anything and you don't have to be saying anything, over time, that will will eventually, I guess, kind of spring forth in making things. So, mm-hmm. you know, because, and for some people that might be solitude. I don't know.
Yeah. Cause he is the creator, and like you said, creativity himself, he is the one who originates within us that desire and that capacity to create. I really like that. So you kind of answered my last question too. And I just wanted to ask you, like, what does your devotional life look like these days? What does your relationship with Jesus? And I feel like you answered that very
greatly. if you'd asked me that a few months ago, I would have said highly frustrating. But because of the wisdom that God gave my pastor, it's really good. And I've had my ups and downs since. I've been able to accept that the way that I relate, while having the bedrock foundation of the scriptures, of the Holy Spirit and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, the way that I personally connect is just being with. And that's helped immensely.
Wow. So good. What's your next step? Are you going to continue with Genesis chapter 4? Are you looking for people to shoot ideas for what you want to turn your pen toward?
So my project right now is Genesis. I think that there's a lot of potential there for that kind of epic poetry, especially when we get past Genesis 11, right? There's the whole saga with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, mm-hmm. and how much that will lend itself to, I don't know. I actually have a feeling that because, you know, the first 11 chapters of Genesis cover a massive amount of time, and then I think I've seen it, or I've heard it said that basically the first 11 chapters of Genesis cover the same amount of time as the entire rest of the Bible.
Yeah,
at least. And so right now I'm just like, okay, Genesis. There was a time where it's like, oh, I'm gonna put Exodus and probably won't do Leviticus, but you know, right now I'm just like, all right, I'm just gonna slow down. I'm gonna stick with Genesis. And so, I think next, what comes up next in the actual book is a lot of genealogies. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that. I mean, I'm not like, oh, I have to get every word in there. Cause again, I'm not trying to do a different translation, but there is a lot of really interesting, like, poetic wordplay involved with all the names that I think I would really like to kind of play with. And I did a little bit of that right near the end of chapter 3, where I took the meanings of the names of Cain's descendants and kind of wove them into a sort of poetic summary of everything that had happened, which was really interesting. But I think what I'm doing next is jumping to the flood, which,
okay.
And you know, this kind of goes into the emotion of it. Like I have an issue kind of where how a lot of retellings of the flood focus on, you know, the animals got saved and mm-hmm. just reading on Twitter, someone making a joke earlier today about how it's kind of weird that we have like cutesy murals of Noah's Ark on nursery walls when it's a horrifying story.
Yep.
And I think that what I kind of want to get through is God's heartbrokenness in this.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what I'm going to be diving into next. It's probably going to be in a month and a half or so, because I'm okay having just finished chapter 3. I'm not going to throw myself in, but yeah, I'm really excited about that, and was actually really interested that you picked the articles that you did where you shared with email, because there's a lot of, I guess, tie in there as to worship and devotion and things like that, about what the focus of that should be.
Yeah, well, let's touch on that just a little bit. I was thinking to wrap up here, but you brought it up, and I if you have a few more minutes, I'd love to touch on it. This was a Facebook post. I think I read the article too on Christianity Today, but gentleman Michael Rhodes, an Old Testament scholar, wrote an article, and probably best just to go to Christianity Today, and I'll again post the link. He asked the question, "Why don't we sing justice songs in worship? Let's swap sloppy wet kiss for break the arm of the wicked man." And he just goes through and he says, there's so much sense of justice and calling out the suffering and the oppression, poverty, widows, refugees, on and on, in the book of Psalms, which you kind of think would be sort of our model for our hymnody, for our songbooks, for our PowerPoint worship lyrics. And he noted that nothing nothing that we see in Psalms is represented in the top 25 worship songs. Zero references to the poor or poverty in the top 25. Zero references to widows, refugees, and the oppressed in the top 25 worship songs. And he goes on, and he says, protesting to and even raging at God about injustice is central to the hymnal God himself gave his people. We need those who write worship music to help us sing the Psalms and to write new songs that echo the Psalms' outcry against injustice. So yeah, a really interesting take there. And he did the research on it too. Do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, so I think one thing that really comes up, and I've had conversations, I think I've had at least one conversation with my brothers, I've had conversations with other people, even on Twitter, where someone I think brought up the song The Blessing. The Lord bless you and keep you, make his face smile upon you, which I think is taken from the Aaronic blessing in Exodus or Deuteronomy, one of those. And initially expressing kind of discomfort with singing that, where it seems like we're singing about ourselves. And I think this ties into the justice question, and like you said, and like the article said, it's somewhat lacking, is when you look at two specific passages, and I'm not going to be able to name them off the top of my head, but there's two particular spots where Paul says that we should gather together, we should sing songs and hymns and spiritual songs.
Yep.
Yeah. And he specifically says for encouragement and edification, I believe.
Yep.
And there are people who, not that they're not sincere, but I think there are people who really lean into it. It's like the songs are supposed to be to God. They're supposed to be about God. And yes, God is glorious and he deserves praise, and we should do that. However, we are also there to encourage and uplift each other. And to worship God together, and also to bless each other. And I think so that a worship song can contain songs that have repentance in them. Mm-hmm. They can contain songs that are, in a sense, about us. Mm-hmm.
Paul says himself in the passages you referred to, like Ephesians chapter 5, I think, speaking to one another. Like there's this horizontal communication. I grew up hearing like you noted, oh yeah, worship really should be vertical between me and God, which, you know, we talked about that already. That's important, right? This devotional sense and seeking God and being at peace with God. But a lot of the hymns in the Bible, a lot of this, the psalmody is horizontal as well as vertical. And Paul said that himself. So you're right on track there.
Yeah, and so on the flip side of that, although like there, I think the songs, like, you know, references Sloppy Wet Kiss. I mean, that specific line never really particularly bothered me, but that's, people have argued about that all over the place. But that song where it's like, oh, how he loves me, I've heard people say, I hate that song because it's about us. I'm like, no, it's not. It is us encouraging, frankly, ourselves, yes, but also each other, and like, hey, God loves us, and he is the source of that. That's really important. If there is anything where it's like, I am all that and I am totally great, that's not good. But as long as God is the source and as long as we are praising him for that, I think that we can and should encourage each other with our praise. And what that means is, yeah, songs should have a whole lot more about the difficulty that we face. Mm-hmm. And there are actually even some songs that for different reasons kind of bother me, because I think there's one, I think it's Good, Good Father, which I like the chorus of that one, but it says, I've heard 1,000 stories about what they think you like, but I've heard the tender whisper of love in the dead of night. And I have been in the room where that song was sung so many times. And I'm like, what if somebody's here who hasn't? What if someone's here who's like who really struggles with the concept of God as a father, as a good father, who's in the middle of pain and maybe can't say that they're there and they've heard the whisper of God in the dead of night saying like that he's pleased and that he's proud of me. Like, not that we shouldn't ever sing anything like that.
Yep.
But I really think that we should put maybe more thought into pain. Something that maybe our American or white American culture is not really good at is sitting in pain. And actually just expressing that as opposed to trying to solve it right away.
Yes. Yeah. As opposed to trying to get that easy fix at the end, you know, and wrap it up at the end so everybody can go home with that little emotional high. Michael Rhodes finishes his article on Christianity Today. We're talking about a revolution in the way we sing and pray, a revolution driven neither by smoke machines nor by the theological flavor of the week, but by the very scripts God has given us to use in our life with him. Sounds like a lot of work, but if we embrace it, we might find ourselves singing our way toward the justice that our God loves and our world longs for. And I feel like, you know, one guy in Connecticut at your computer tweeting out poetry. In a small way, you're trying to do that. You're trying to give us another way of approaching God and experiencing the messages of God. So I'll be following your work closely and look forward to seeing what comes next.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this, and it's been a delight.
That Jesus podcast is part of the Kingdom Outpost Podcast Network. For more articles, podcasts, and other resources, go to kingdomoutpost.org.